Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Radio Show. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice, our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. Oh, yes. Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is The Healthy Mind Podcast for January 9th, 2013. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. I have a great podcast planned for you today. We're going to be talking about sleep and insomnia and how hard it is sometimes for all of us to get a good night's sleep. And really, talking about the psychology of it, why is it that we start to get anxious about falling asleep? Will we get a good night's sleep or not? And also talk about some very basic, some very simple things to do that will increase your chances of getting a good night's sleep. So we are talking about sleep on The Healthy Mind this week. In the second half of the podcast, wow, some very, very interesting research that was done, some great studies that are really relevant, particularly parents. You're going to want to hear this. Popular drinks that increase your risk for depression. Wow, a really, really fascinating study that was out. And the importance of getting anything done, no matter what it is, without interruptions, how interruptions, even though they're brief, can cause amazing errors. So we'll talk about both of those towards the second half of the podcast. In news, we'll do headlines. We have a great podcast today, so I am really glad that you're here. So, let's begin. Okay, well, on to this week's topic, the topic of sleep. How many of us are getting a good night's sleep? You know what they say, the average recommended amount of sleep is right around 8 hours, 7 to 9 hours for adults. And for teenagers, parents, well, a minimum of 9 hours. And we've talked about this before on The Healthy Mind. How often, or rather, the lack of how often that is happening in today's culture. And really, we can talk about the reasons why we're not sleeping because we're so busy, or that we don't treat sleep with the importance that it should really have in our lives. But for millions of people, in fact, tonight, after you listen to this podcast, you may be one of them. Millions of people in this country who are not going to sleep well. Not because they don't have enough time to sleep, but that they can't sleep. They're having problems with insomnia. And there's so many different causes of insomnia. And really, my goal today is not really to talk about all of those, but what I want to focus on is really the psychology of sleep, why we begin to have problems with sleep, the psychology and the emotions that then roll into the fear of not getting a good night's sleep, and really talk about some very basic and very simple things that we can do to tip the odds in our favor that we'll get a better night's sleep, okay? Before we start talking about how to sleep better, let's understand what happens to our body when we go to sleep. And really, when we look at the restorative effects of sleep, getting a better night's sleep, where you wake up refreshed, a lot of times people think that I just have to have a lot of deep sleep to be able to feel rested. And while that's true, it's not for the reason that you think. Our body goes through multiple levels of sleep as we go through the night. And many people know there's stage 1, 2, 3, 4, and then REM sleep. And as you go down the road, down to REM sleep, which is the deepest sleep, that whole process can take about 90 minutes. Now, what we have to understand is the restorative aspect of sleep, where you feel refreshed, isn't just the absolute amount of time that you spend in each stage, particularly the deep stages. The reason that we feel refreshed is because we go through the cycles, many cycles. As we go through the night, naturally our body is going to increase the amount of deep sleep that we get, increasing the amount of REM sleep or dream sleep that we have, from stage 1 being the lightest sleep to REM sleep, where our eyes are moving, our brain may be very active, our muscles are paralyzed, and we're dreaming, but it is a deep stage of sleep. And researchers have looked at this, and really you start off maybe the first couple cycles going through them, 1, 2, 3, 4, REM, and you get about 10 minutes of REM, and then this increases throughout the night. So when you read or hear about someone, an expert, whoever it may be, telling you about the need for 7 to 8 hours of sleep, it's because as you move along the stages of sleep and cycle through them, deep sleep becomes longer as you move along. And if you can get an extra hour of sleep, that is where you're going to get the most deep sleep, but you're going through that extra cycle. Okay, so I hope people understand that. It's about going through the cycles of sleep, not necessarily just how much time you spend in an individual stage of sleep. So you can understand an extra hour, an extra half hour, even though it doesn't seem like much, if it's another full cycle of sleep, you are getting an incredible amount of deep sleep. So when you're thinking about cutting corners and not getting sleep, this is what you're missing out on, and it's that restorative deep sleep that has most of the health benefits, and this includes both physical and emotional health and well-being. So this is how we have to understand sleep. But we've been there, right? All of us have been there, where we want to get to sleep, and we don't know what's going on, but we have a bad night of sleep. We don't sleep well. Maybe we can't get to sleep, or we're worried, and we're up. And suddenly, it starts. And it's 1 o'clock, and then it's 2 o'clock, and, well, I'm afraid to look at the alarm clock. I don't want to see what time it is, so I turn the clock the other way. I throw a pillow over it. And it's getting late, and you're praying that you fall asleep before you start to see the hint of light in the sky. Or you start to see the dawn coming, and how frustrating it is. And not only that, now you've had a bad night's sleep, but now the emotions kick in, and the fear begins to kick in. We worry. Oh my gosh, is tonight going to be that night where I don't sleep again? What if I don't get a good night's sleep? What if I don't sleep at all? At all, at all, at all, at all. And really, when I talk to people and we're thinking about treatment for insomnia, it is so important to make sure that you are doing everything you can psychologically and emotionally to set yourself up for a good night's sleep. And oftentimes when we review, some things seem very, very intuitive and easy and understandable, and other things, well, like we all are, you know, we kind of cheat around it, and it can take away from our ability to sleep. But this emotional part can be really, really difficult, where we really worry about getting to sleep. In fact, researchers have talked about this, and it's known as insomniaphobia, literally the fear of going to sleep. And oftentimes, insomniaphobia comes from the fact that we haven't slept well, and now we start to obsess on it and worry, and maybe don't have any clocks in our room or whatever, to decrease the anxiety about getting to sleep. And what I want to do is talk about a few things that I hope can be helpful in maybe lowering that level of anxiety for you and some solid things that you can do to improve your chances of a better night's sleep. And I think the first part, if you are struggling with any kind of insomnia that has really gotten to be a problem, that really is a discussion to have with your doctor or medical health professional, okay? If it's serious where you're not getting a whole lot of sleep, it may require medical attention, okay? So what I'm trying to offer are some practical tips that can maybe aid you a bit. But really, if you're having a big problem with sleep, that's a discussion between you and your doctor. But with that in mind, one of the most common things that we cheat around and don't realize is the effect of light. The effect of light, particularly around the hour or two before we go to bed. Now, think about your routine. What do you typically do before you're going to bed? And a lot of times when I'm asking people about their routine before sleep, well, they're spending time on the computer, right? Or if not on the computer, on a tablet or on a phone, just checking out the day's news, reading a little bit, maybe an e-reader that isn't e-paper, but is more of a typical light display, and they're reading. But the important thing to understand is part of the reason we start to fall asleep is that our body is keeping cues on the amount of light in the environment around us. So one of the easiest things that we can do to increase our chances for getting a better night's sleep is to minimize and decrease the amount of light that is directly in front of us. Now, that doesn't mean in the hour before you walk around your house with absolutely no lights on and have to wear night vision goggles. But keep an eye on what you're doing. And if you're finding yourself in front of the computer or in front of a tablet, literally in the last half hour, 45 minutes before you go to sleep, think about replacing that maybe with a newspaper or a magazine or a good book. And that oftentimes will allow for sleep to come on much more quickly than when someone is reading in front of a computer or a phone. And I say a phone because I've had many people come in and tell me just from the light of a small phone, smartphone, it has wired them after they've been reading for a period of 5 or 10 minutes, and they start to feel less tired at the time they're supposed to be falling asleep. So lights are very important. And one thing I do want to talk about here as well, keep this in mind. There was a study that was done about a year ago, and it was not about the amount of light that triggered insomnia, but the amount of dark. And what they talked about was insomnia that could be triggered by a fear of the dark. And what really surprised these researchers, it was a fairly small study, but 100 people or so, half of the individuals, the adults, stated that being in a completely dark room made them feel uneasy. And they were more likely to respond nervously to sounds or something that they perceived was going on in the environment around them. So not only could it be that there's too much light that's keeping you awake, but have an honest discussion with yourself. Is it too dark? A simple nightlight in the room may make all the difference in the world for allowing you to calm down so that you can fall asleep. Now, what about when you are nervous and focused on, oh my gosh, am I going to sleep tonight? Is this going to be the night? Oh, I don't want to look at the alarm clock. What time is it already? Oh my gosh, what am I going to do? Okay, what you need to do first off is relax. And I know that's so easy for me to say, but I want you to think about what's the worst that could happen. The worst that could happen if you don't sleep that night at all. You're going to feel bad, but it's not as if you're not going to be able to do anything. In fact, studies have been done, and even though people have been sleep deprived, they don't do tasks as well as they could when they were sleeping well the night before. But they're not walking around where they can't speak or can't write or can't talk to each other. So I think having an honest understanding of what it would mean at its worst if you slept 0 hours or 1 or 2 oftentimes is not as bad as just the fear of not sleeping. Because we don't know. It's the unknown. What do you mean I'm not going to sleep tonight? I mean, well, I'm not going to be able to function tomorrow. And the reality is, yeah, you probably are going to function tomorrow, even if you don't get any sleep. It's just not going to be a happy time for you. Okay, so oftentimes, really understanding what you're fearing can help to lower the anxiety. And for many, many people, the changes that you have to make in order to sleep better, you really have to manage your insomnia, not necessarily put into place the steps that are going to make you fall asleep completely. Okay? Managing your anxiety. I'm going to sleep better. I can do these various things to improve my night's sleep. I don't have to have everything figured out that night so that I sleep 8 hours perfect. It takes the pressure off. Okay? Understanding what it is that terrifies you about not sleeping at all through the night. What does that mean the next day? And how can I manage that fear and realize that it's probably not going to be as bad as I thought? And then the wake-up time. Ah, yes, the wake-up time. And I've touched upon this before many, many times on The Healthy Mind, and really, if there's one behavioral change that anybody makes to reorient their sleep and get themselves sleeping better, is to have a consistent wake-up time no matter how much or how little you've slept the night before. Pick the time. If it's 8 a.m., whether you go to bed at midnight or you go to bed at 6 a.m., you wake up at 8 a.m. In time, your body is going to adjust. It just does. That is so important. And if you take nothing from this podcast, a consistent wake-up time is one of the most important keys to a good night's sleep. And finally, one of the most important things is to figure out a way to anxiety-proof your bedtime, the sleep time. Not just the time around sleep, but your room itself. How do you make it less anxiety-provoking? And that may involve removing a TV and other sources of light, like a computer and a tablet, so it's not so handy to you should you wake up or get up or try to fall asleep and turn to it like you need something to do. Another thing for many people, believe me, I can relate, I don't think I've had my alarm clock on for a year or two. Get rid of the alarm clock, okay? We don't need necessarily a big clock with the red lights beaming to tell us that it's 3 a.m. You can program your alarm into your phone, and you don't have to look at the time. So doing things like that can decrease the amount of anxiety that you have about falling asleep. But okay, you're in bed, you're there. Oh, Zafiridis told me to do all of this and nothing's happening. That quack. I'm still not sleeping. The Healthy Mind, my you know what. Okay. One of the most effective things to help you relax when you're in bed and that anxiety is starting to rev up, or you're starting to worry about, is tonight going to be the night, or I can't sleep, why can't I sleep? There's a million things going through my head, the bills, the family, the kids, the mortgage, everything. I just can't stop. I can't stop thinking about it and worrying. Breathe. Breathe. It's a really simple concept that's a little bit harder than you may think, but it really can help. So the next time you're in bed and sleep's not coming, I invite you to take some time and just focus on your breathing. You don't have to move anywhere from your bed to do anything. No special positions, nothing. You're already in the position that you should be in. But begin to listen to your breathing in and out and in and out, and you focus on that. As thoughts start to come into your mind trying to bother you, whether it's, am I going to sleep tonight, or am I going to get that presentation right, or am I going to pass that test tomorrow, start breathing in and out and listening to it and focusing. You've got to work at it at first. It's not that easy because those thoughts just want to crawl right over and start pounding around in your brain. But focus on that breathing. Focus on it. And listen to it and look for it. you'll find that it is a very, very effective tool. In fact, I will use that when I have one of those nights where I'm just revved up or I've got a lot on my mind. Closing my eyes and just listening to myself breathe, and it just slows me down. It just slows me down. You'll find that some of these things are very basic and they're very, very easy to do. Of course, we know all of the basic stuff. Don't drink a lot of caffeine before you're going to bed. Alcohol and sleep, even though you feel it might help you to fall asleep, it really works against you in getting good sleep. Don't exercise so close to bedtime, and really try and have some basic routine that you go from any work or studying that you're doing at the end of the night. Give yourself a little bit of time before you get right into bed. All of those things are really, really basic. And of course, exercise and diet. But when we talk about the anxiety and the worry and the fear of getting to sleep, that's a different thing. And hopefully, by using some of these tips, it can just add that much of a push to take you from a night where you are going to be anxious and awake to relaxed and asleep. And that, my friends, is a wonderful step to take down our road to the healthy mind. And now it's time for news. Okay, well, another very, very busy week for health news. The first story, and I talked about this right at the beginning of the podcast. Do you drink soda? Pop, Coke, whatever it may be. Do you like having soft drinks? Well, you may have a different view about it after this next story. The headline, Diet Soda is Linked to an Increased Risk of Depression. Amazing. Now, sweetened drinks as well led to an increased risk, but at a lower rate. And interestingly, researchers found that coffee, as long as it's unsweetened, lowered the rate of depression. Now, this was new research that came from scientists at the National Institute of Health that showed that drinking sweet beverages, especially those diet drinks, is linked with an increased risk of depression. Now, according to the study author, Dr. Honglei Chen, quote, sweetened beverages, coffee, and tea are commonly consumed worldwide and have important physical and may have important mental health consequences. Now, they're going to present the results of their study at the annual American Academy of Neurology National Meeting. But it was a fascinating study. Over 260,000 people were studied between the ages of 50 and 71. And what they did was they took a look at what their consumption of all different types of drinks, but soft drinks as well as coffee, between 1995 and 1996, and then they followed them for 10 years and asked if any of them had been diagnosed with depression. And of those over 260,000 people, over 11,000 had been diagnosed with depression. So what were the specific results? This is, it's pretty ominous. People who drank more than 4 cans or 4 cups of soda a day were 30% more likely to develop depression than those who drank no soda at all. Now listen to this. Those that drank more than 4 cans of fruit punch a day were 38% more likely to develop depression than those that didn't drink sweetened drinks at all. Fruit punch. Now the risk appeared to be much greater for those that were drinking diet drinks than sweet drinks. So think about that. Diet drinks. How many of us will have diet drinks or drink them regularly? Well, might be time to think again. Now, the interesting part, coffee. Oh, thank goodness. Coffee consumption was studied as well. And what they found was that those individuals that drank about 4 cups of coffee a day were about 10% less likely to develop depression than those that didn't drink coffee at all. Now back to Dr. Chen, quote, our research suggests that cutting out or down on sweetened diet drinks or replacing them with unsweetened coffee may naturally help lower depression risk. End of quotes. Now, it's an early study. There's a lot here to consider. What comes to mind for me is, what role do these sugars maybe play in inflammation, or even the diet colas and aspartame and the like? What role do they play in inflammation, which may increase the risk? But they didn't really go into the details or the reasons why they think that this happened. It was more of just a cross-sectional study that noticed these differences. So sweetened drinks, beverages, sodas, especially those diet sodas, they could add to an increased risk of depression. How about that? Okay, the next news piece. Now, how many times has this happened to you, right? You're ready to start focusing on something. It might be doing an email or a project, or you're writing or studying, anything. It can be something small. And the phone rings, or you get a text, or someone asks you a question. Well, that could cost you dearly. Why? Because scientists at Michigan State University have found that interruptions, even if they're short, create the potential for serious errors. The headline, "Even Brief Interruptions Spawn Errors." In short interruptions, I mean, even something like the buzzing of your phone or a text, have a surprisingly large effect on an individual's ability to accurately complete a task. Now, researchers at Michigan State University studied about 300 people, and they had them do a sequence-based kind of procedure on a computer. And what they found was that interruptions of about 3 seconds doubled the error rate. 3 seconds doubled the error rates. Now, it's everywhere, right? I mean, our interruptions are part of our daily life. That's the thing. I mean, we get bothered all the time. Just think about your daily routine, and how often is it that you are totally at peace with no one interrupting you? And the researchers at Michigan State University said this has huge implications when small errors could be disastrous, say like airplane mechanics or emergency room doctors. According to Dr. Eric Altman from Michigan State University, quote, "What this means is that our health and safety is, on some level, contingent on whether people looking after it have been interrupted," end of quotes. Now, those who were involved in the study, the participants, were asked to perform a number of different tasks. What they would do is they'd identify with tapping on a key whether a letter was closer to the beginning or to the end of the alphabet. And sometimes the participants were interrupted and told to type 2 letters, which took about 3 seconds, before returning to the task. And when this happened, this is when the researchers found they were twice as likely to make an error on the sequence. Now, these results stumped even the researchers. Dr. Altman was blown away by the fact that such short interruptions could cause such a large effect, because he was stating that the interruptions last no longer than each step of the task. So the time factor wasn't the real cause of the errors. So why did the error rate go up? According to Dr. Altman, quote, "The answer is that the participants had to shift their attention from one task to another. Even momentary interruptions can seem jarring when they occur during a process that takes considerable thought," end of quote. And what they had suggested, particularly for these high-risk environments like airlines or emergency rooms, that you spend the money to design an environment that protects against interruptions. So, a small interruption can have a huge effect on you being able to complete a task correctly. It may be time to start shutting off that phone the next time you've got something very, very important to do. Okay. With the time that we have left, I just want to blast through the rest of the news in a segment I like to call the Healthy Mind Headlines. Okay, the first headline. Fussy babies spend more time in front of the TV. Moms, especially those who are obese, are more likely to use TV to entertain and soothe infants who are more fussy and active, according to researchers at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The next headline, dopamine receptor gene linked to human longevity. A variant of the gene associated with active personality traits in humans seems to be also involved with living a longer life. And this was research on dopamine, one of the mood neurochemicals, at the University of California at Irvine. And finally, this was really interesting. The headline, cup color influences the taste of hot chocolate. Oh yes, the color of the cup. Two researchers from the Polytechnic University of Valencia and the University of Oxford have proven that hot chocolate tastes better in an orange or cream-colored cup than in a white or red one. This study adds to recent research demonstrating how our senses perceive food in a different way depending on the characteristics of the container from which we eat and drink. Oh man, the amazing, amazing power of the human mind. How taste can be influenced by color. Wild. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have done it again, you and I. We have made it to the end of yet another broadcast of The Healthy Mind. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. Please don't hesitate to sign up for the free monthly newsletter. You can find the tab right there on the homepage. Follow me anytime on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Zafiridis. And any questions, comments, anything that you want to talk about, I want to hear from you. Don't hesitate to email me. The email address, peter@thehealthymind.com. That's peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on The Healthy Mind.